we turn to our friend who joins us every week at this time, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, buddy?
Well, I'm looking forward to talking about one of my favorite people, and nobody knows his work better than you do, Orson Welles. And when I mention to people where you're talking about scary Orson Welles, first thing they think of is War of the Worlds, but we're not even going to go there.
No, your people have gone there enough by this juncture. Of course, the famous, super famous, infamous War of the Worlds broadcast, which terrified people reputedly into believing the Martians had attacked us, which actually didn't really quite happen. A bit of fake news even at the time. Welles had to apologize, and he was terrified because he thought that could be the end of his career right there, which was pretty booming in those early days. But yes, that is what he was doing on Halloween 1938, and what gave him something of a reputation that confounded him as a thriller guy. Now, we have to realize that thriller back then meant something a little bit different than the term does now, because there was a hesitancy to go there and to outrightly call something horror. So films like Bride of Frankenstein, Dracula, whatnot, those sorts of pictures, those were billed as thrillers during the time. And so Welles was branded with that label, and it amused him.
Well, in the same year that he did War of the Worlds, 1938, the Mercury Theater did a wonderful production of Dracula.
I think as a piece of radio art, Dracula might be more stunning than War of the Worlds. When you listen to it, it's a wonder that they got away with it, because it's such a sexualized novel. It is, the 1897 novel, is as sexual as you can really get in prose form, not just then, but I think in any time in the intervening years. And Welles played that up, and it worked well to his strength as a radio virtuoso, because Stoker's novel is a collage novel. It's a postmodern novel before postmodernism really existed. I think somebody like James Joyce spent quite a bit of time reading Dracula. It's not some straight ahead, let's just say how this story happened type of novel. It's not a strictly letters-based novel. It's put together from, it's Frankenstein together, really, from a lot of different scraps of things. And Welles was a master cutter. He was ruthless in what he would just rip out of Shakespeare, for instance, and he would red pen stuff to death and put in what he wanted to put in. And he does that with his production of Dracula, which has some of the most intense breathing, really, on the radio. Some of the things that you're hearing in there, it's like you're clasped together with somebody and their mouth is over your ear, and there's going to be a certain, like, grunting progression, and you're hearing that on the radio in 1938, and the radio at the time was like TV or Netflix now. So people were listening to this, and they must have been like, oh, wow, can't believe you're doing that, sir.
Well, Welles did so many great horror/terror productions on radio, including a number of them when he was playing Lamont Cranston in The Shadow, and just a year before War of the Worlds, he did one of the best, I should say.
So Halloween 1937, he has a very different gig, and he's like 22, 23 at this point. And The Shadow is a really strange series, right? When you listen to it now, the people were so entertained by this. It's a superhero, but kind of not really a superhero, but he's awesome at manifesting himself in places he's not. That's kind of a superpower. And throwing his voice, that's really like The Shadow's main thing. And so Orson Welles, he's this young man about town with this secret identity, and he has Agnes Moorehead as his female companion. Their relationship is never really defined. Helping him out is sort of Lois Lane, who's in on the trick. And it's very funny to listen to The Shadow now. And this one, three ghosts. And he is messing with these guys. The Shadow is so passive-aggressive, right, in these productions. He messes with you, and he's like, I've done this because I can. And the crook's like, come on, man, I'm guilty here. You know how this is going, Dan. He's like, no, you amuse me. And then after that, after he's done, it's all sort of just whitewashed away, because in the end, the bad guy pays the price. But The Shadow, he is an absolute dick as a superhero. Orson Welles really lays into the role, and people think that that famous, who knows what evil lurks in the heart of men. Well, actually, most people are evil, and there's a lot lurking in their hearts that's not so great. But that is not Orson Welles who was saying that. People think that that's him because it's a signature vocal turn. And who better than Orson Welles, though, to play a superhero who throws his voice? And if we think of something like Frankenstein from 1931, this was a staple of horror, voice throwing. The monster at the end, when he gate crashes the wedding, if you pay close attention to that scene, his voice is reverberating at all the different levels of Frankenstein's manner. And he's throwing his voice, and that's what the shadow does. That's his main shtick, and that is how he nabs the bad guy.
Well, I fell in love with radio because of the shadow. I'm not that old, but when I was a kid, a local station here would broadcast the shadow every night, the original episodes, and I got completely hooked on that and the power of radio. Welles also did a number of productions of Lucille Fletcher's work, The Hitchhiker, which is, everybody's done a version of that through the years, but I don't know if anybody did it better than Orson Welles.
He returned to it a lot, and The Hitchhiker is, it's become a horror trope, really, that concept. We talked recently about Carnival of Souls, and let's be honest, that is half-inched from The Hitchhiker, this idea of something has happened, and you're dead, but you haven't been tapped on the shoulder and officially told, hey, you're dead, that sucks, move on. And so it's about that. There's, of course, a Twilight Zone episode that's the exact same thing. And the original story comes from an English writer who is maybe more well-known for situational comedies now, a guy named E.F. Benson, and he wrote a story called The Bus Conductor. I think Benson is a better ghost story writer. He has a larger heart to his ghost stories than M.R. James. And Welles is awesome in this role. Any of the versions you hear, whether it's from 1941 on his own radio program or 1945 when he's on Suspense, which was a long running and probably is the radio program of the thriller variety that has aged the best. And his voice, do you notice how much he changes his voice in these different roles? Mm. Yet it never sounds like an affectation, right?
Right.
He began his acting career before, of course, he was a director. He directed student plays. But when he was in Ireland and he was a teenager, 17 years old, and he was talking his way up onto the stage so he could walk the boards, and he would have this cod Irish accent. You hear the Irish accent in some of his films, right? So some of his noir pictures. And it's just this fantastic telling of this super creepy cross-country journey that actually ended very early on a bridge. And the part where he phones home to his mom's house and doesn't speak to his mom because his mom has had a breakdown. And Welles, it's a solo piece of just him talking, really. And it's just this bravura turn. It's really remarkable. It's terrifying, and it is heartbreaking. He said at one point, look, I don't know why I'm known for these thrillers. You know, you have these thrillers, and they impact the spine. And I do more stories that impact the heart. But I think what you can do, why can't you do both simultaneously? And people have never looked at horror that way. It never happens with horror. It's all about the spine, and it's rarely about the heart. And here we have that commingling in this particular broadcast.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown about the scary side of Orson Welles. And we have to mention his 1948 version of Macbeth. You've written about that before. What makes this a horror take on classic Shakespeare?
Oh, it's unreal, this film. You wonder, like, what was going through this guy's head? And he shot it in something like 23 days. There was a day for retakes. And he was at Republic Studios. Republic Studios, it was the only place Orson Welles could get work. This is within the decade of Citizen Kane. That's what has happened to this guy. And he's at the beginning of a period of being blackballed, essentially, throughout Hollywood. And Republic was a studio for serial pictures and cheap jack westerns. And they had no confidence, even with a limited budget, that he could make anything that would make the studio any money. He had to sign like this codicil that he would, if the budget went over this amount, he would pay for that himself. And he had already done Voodoo Macbeth, that famous all-black Harlem version of Macbeth. Mm. And you had Laurence Olivier doing Shakespeare productions at the same time. And Republic was just terrified to put this out because Olivier's pictures, like Hamlet, they were so clean cut. And here you have this primordial ooze of a Shakespeare production. It is like it is slithered out of the muck to claim a place upon terra firma. It looks like nothing else in all of Shakespearean cinema. And Welles actually based some of the mise-en-scene on Bride of Frankenstein. You might think, like, Orson Welles is spending his time watching James Whale pictures. But, yeah, he was. And the fog, everything is shrouded. Everything is overgrown. Everything is mangy. It's this living fungi of a picture. And it looks like nothing else. People are dressed in, like, loincloth. Now, part of that is because of the budget. But Welles could make an absence of funds work for him. We see that in Othello with the Turkish bath scene, for instance, where the costumes don't show up and they're like, let's just have it in kind of a sauna. That'll work. And this is that sort of hothouse atmosphere, but it's a chilling. And he cuts out a lot of the Shakespeare. He cuts out a lot from Duncan. And the bit at the end when he's going to do battle with Macduff, it makes me just want to pop somebody. Because even though you know he's on his way out, when he just says, lay on, it's like, oh, yeah, let's do this.
One of the reasons why I love talking with you, why I'm glad we're friends, is because you always introduce me to something new that I didn't know about, and I watched it this morning. Holy cow, I love this short film that he did with his old buddies from Dublin. Was it Hilton Edwards and Michael McLeamore, Return to Glenniscall? Oh, my God, that is awesome.
Yes, and that was shot during a break in the protracted filming of the aforementioned Othello. So this is 1951. Edwards and McLeamore were actually a couple, and they were the two who first met Welles when he came to Dublin. And they respected the size of his balls, that he was trying to talk his way up onto the stage. Who does that, right? And he kind of threw them a bone, saying, like, I will be in this picture. And if you note at the very beginning, they're shooting Othello. It actually starts very metafiction in the beginning. And if you look at the way that shooting is orchestrated, it's very similar to the trailers for Citizen Kane and Magnificent Amberson, which were separate films, mini films, really, apart from their actual proper pictures. It's not like the Star Wars hodgepodge. It's like, oh, C-3PO is probably going to sacrifice himself. Oh, no. It's much more artful than that. And Welles is out on the road in the desolate Ireland night, and he meets a guy who tells him this very uncanny, unnerving story about a time when the guy was driving. He picked up two women. He took them back to their place. He forgets something there. He goes back, and the home he had dropped them off at is ruined. Nobody has lived there in decades, century, whatever it may be. And it's funny, too. There's a lot of wit in this piece, because the guy then says to Welles, he's like, oh, hey, you want to swing by? We'll have, like, a nightcap. And Welles is like, no, I'll see you, dude. You're out. Off you go. And he comes upon a flesh and blood pair of women, and he doesn't pick them up because he thinks this is going to happen to me, too. It's sort of a frame story. He moves on, and one of them turns to this, like, was that him? Was that Orson Welles? So it's very cheeky in that sense. But the atmosphere of it, it's like a 23-minute film, and it is this possessive atmosphere, really. It's what you want in a ghost story. And the concept is so simple. But when we have a concept like that, it's one of those, why didn't I think of that, right? Because nobody would. It's like when Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday. He's going around. It's like, have you heard this melody? Somebody must have done this before. It's kind of like the short film version of that.
Well, they're not all works of art, though. And let's close by talking about 1972's Necromancy.
Yeah, sometimes you just have to get your dead on, as they say. That was the tagline. No. Oh, that was good. That should have been the tagline, right?
Yeah.
It is, Welles is employed. Well, actually, he's the employer. He is, he likes covens. He likes resurrecting the dead in this one. And he happens to have the job of guy who runs a toy company who was going to occasionally recruit people into evil basements. And actually, I'm hesitant to make the connection, but I think it is a real one. It borrows the frame story device from 1945's Dead of Night, which is an excellent English picture that somehow got made despite there really not being horror pictures in the middle of the 1940s in England with the war on and all of that. And that story is about an architect. And at the end of the story, the architect, he goes to a country house and he, all the people staying there, people from his dreams. And at the end of the story, it kind of starts again. And it's not so much something that was dreamed as what we might perceive of as an indication of things to come. And that's what this story is. And Wells is, I don't want to say that he was whoring it around to make money, because, again, he's in this bad situation that everybody hates this man in Hollywood, and they will not let him work. So unless he's lending his voice to pictures like this, that presence, he had the voice of God and all of that going on, and he lent a certain vocal credibility. So he was using this to throw back into things like The Other Side of the Wind, right, which got all that fanfare last year from Netflix. But he's always professional in these things. Like, he is as good as a satanic coven-leading toy factory baron can be, I guess, for what that's worth. But it is it's funny. It's the type of thing that you would watch late at night, laugh over, go to the drive-in back in the day and see, have a few pops with your buddies kind of picture.
There you go. Lots of options for your Halloween season viewing or listening pleasure from Orson Welles and our friend Colin Fleming. Thank you, Colin.
All right. Thank you, sir.